Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too.
Aw,
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Misinformation, disinformation, lack of trust in institutions that has been caused by, you know, centuries of systemic racism, huge problems. How do you even start to go about fixing those as you guys are sitting down and putting this plan together?
Yeah, like we can't fix all that. We can't fix that. We can't fix systemic racism. I think that too often this conversation, particularly around misinformation and disinformation, is just too ambitious. You know, like, how are we going to solve this? Well,
people lying.
That's right. A tough one. Well, yeah. We'll shut down Facebook and Twitter first and then go back to like landlines, no cell phones.
I'm Jon Favreau. Welcome to Offline.
Hey, everyone. My guest this week is Lauren Williams, former editor in chief of Vox and now founder and CEO of Capital B News. So last week, I happened to catch part of the University of Chicago's conference on disinformation and the erosion of democracy. My old boss, Barack Obama, sat down for an interview. There were also a few offline guests who spoke, like Kara Swisher, Charlie Warzel, and Abby Richards. But the panel that stuck with me the most was about the ways the media establishes and builds trust with their audience in an online environment that's filled with misinformation. And Lauren was one of the speakers. She talked about the media's failures in covering something we've all heard too much about, critical race theory. She talked about how much of the national media tends to frame critical race theory as white parents being concerned about what their white kids are learning at school, and pointed out that we usually don't hear about the perspectives of black parents, black kids, and black educators. Then she talked about how she's working to solve this problem. Earlier this year, Lauren and fellow journalist Akoto Aforiata launched Capital B News, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on black voices, audience needs, and experiences. In an age of clickbait and hot takes, Capital B is novel. As a nonprofit, they're free from the demands of ad revenue or subscriptions. And as a media outlet that focuses on local as well as national news, they have a team in Atlanta, they're setting up newsrooms in communities as a way to rebuild trust between journalists and the people they cover. In fact, Capital B's mission is to, quote, be an antidote to the misinformation, disinformation, and low-quality, low-context news that clouds our information pipelines. I wanted to talk to Lauren about this mission, so we met up in a studio in D.C. What followed was a great conversation about how Capital B is trying to chip away at the flood of online misinformation and take on systemic racism by going back to the basics of journalism, rebuilding trust in the communities they cover by telling the complicated, nuanced, in-depth stories that matter to those communities, by trying to make sure that some people's voices are finally heard. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or complaints, feel free to email us at offline@crooked.com. And of course, please rate, review, and share the show. Here's Lauren Williams. Lauren Williams, welcome to Offline.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, I heard you speak at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, I guess it was the Disinformation Conference last week. And I wanted to chat because we spend a lot of time on this show talking about how the internet has contributed to the problems of disinformation and institutional distrust. You're working on a solution in Capital B that's both specific and creative, which is trying to rebuild trust in Black communities with journalism for Black communities. But I'd love to start with sort of the journey that got you to where you are now. You were editor-in-chief at Vox until February of 2021, I believe.
Yes.
Okay. When and what made you start thinking, maybe I want to do my own thing?
I wasn't like thinking about this for a very long time. I mean, in the back of my head, obviously, I think in the back of everyone's head, there's a sense of like, what if I started a business within my profession? But nothing close to like, I'm almost there in any way, shape or form. But what changed that was really the summer of 2020. It was, if you recall, if anyone can recall, a difficult time.
Oh, yes.
For a variety of different reasons. And just from the perspective of a leader in a newsroom, which was Vox at the time, it was just simply like one of the hardest moments of my life with combined personal and professional. I was at home with my 4-year-old who is autistic and my baby trying to run the newsroom. Times were tight in terms of advertising dollars, and so all media companies were cutting back, and the stories we were covering were really difficult and thorny, from the pandemic to the George Floyd protests to the primaries at that point. And it all combined to, create almost like a powder keg within me of like, what am I doing? What is happening here? What is next for me? And I think the place where it kind of solidified the most was around, being a Black woman in a position of authority and privilege in a newsroom, which is relatively rare. Watching the quote unquote reckoning happen in the journalism industry, where Black journalists at the time were, rising up and saying, the way that we've been treated has been unfair. You've ignored our ideas and our criticisms about how we cover Black people and Black communities. And also, many of us have been pushed away from covering these stories painted as biased simply because we're Black. It occurred to me that, the experience that I had, the experience that my co-founder and friend Akoto Foriata had, we could really take that and put it towards something that felt much more in that wild moment, something that would be really, really, really worth how hard everything was.
Yeah.
And it's like, if it's going to be this hard, we should be channeling our expertise towards something that's not already kind of happening. And that is the moment that we really decided to like branch out and do a thing.
What was it like directing and shaping the coverage of George Floyd's murder and the subsequent protest?
There's no newsroom that feels like they have enough resources or enough people. And we didn't have enough people.
And harder in a pandemic.
And harder when you're covering a pandemic and you're covering all the other news that's happening. And the story was so multi-layered that, finding all the ways to wrap our arms around it was difficult. And I think, I think we did some good work on it. And I think we did some good work on all of the mini stories that we were covering. But because of the remote aspect of that moment, it was hard. It was a really hard story to do justice, and I think that that was just part of the many underpinnings of thinking about Capital B, thinking about a news organization that wasn't pulled in quite as many directions and could really focus on and center Black people in the coverage.
How do you think the national media as a whole handled covering the protests, and like, did you have sort of personal reactions that you felt weren't being reflected in the coverage?
Yes, I always do. Again, this is another part of why we're doing this, but I think that the lack of diversity in America's newsrooms played out in a lot of different ways during that coverage. And one of the things that really bothers me about coverage of Black people in mainstream media is, it's just this like, well, polls say that that this is how people, Black people, feel, and we're gonna sort of just like go with that incredibly flattened picture. And I think there's other groups in the country, like, working class white people, who don't get flattened in that way. And in fact, get a lot of attention.
Yeah, they don't just get the poll, they get the diner interview.
Yeah, they get the diner interview, and like and the we need to pay more attention to them sorts of talks in inside newsrooms. But I felt like the complicated nature of Black people, our relationship to police, our desire for safety in our communities, and the ways that those things really can clash against each other often, that was just missing.
Yeah.
And so it became to me also after a while a story about white people's awakening to Black people's problems in this country, and because that's what kind of was happening to the white people in newsrooms. And that's certainly not really the story of what's happening here. And so like it ended up, I think it just lost the plot. And of course, there was really great work done during that time in all kinds of newsrooms. But I think you look back at it and also look back at what's kind of happened since, it just was very reflective of the issues that have plagued mainstream media forever.
Right, which is you do get some real substantive, good investigative journalism, and then there's sort of a hive mind dynamic that just flattens the whole issue. And everything becomes very two-dimensional, and it's sort of boiled down to, like you said, what's the polling? One side is saying this, one side is saying the other thing, and it's all caricatured, and then we're sort of like moving on because no one can like pay attention to anything for longer than a week.
Right. And then where I was at Vox, to return to the previous question, is just like, as a Black woman editor-in-chief, I felt an enormous amount of pressure on myself that we should have like the perfect coverage. And it really, like, to a moment that was already incredibly stressful, became like a real stressor for me of like, am I appropriately representing? And also, like, I was the senior vice president at Vox, so I was in charge of our business operations. So I was also I couldn't always focus like 100% on editorial. And it just became this sort of like weight hanging over me of like, other people can mess up, but I can't mess up. And that's like a really heavy thing to deal with, which I didn't think about at the time. And I've just reflected on since. It's like part of the struggle.
Yeah, it was a brutal summer, regardless of where you were. And it's interesting, you talked about the how you also handled the business side too. Like, we were all there at the beginning of the pandemic, or in a couple of months in, when all the advertising dollars seemed like they were going to dry up, and mm-hmm. we all didn't know if they were going to come back.
Right, right.
And you're like, well, that's how we all run our companies here.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, I want to make sure everyone has a job, and we're in the middle of the pandemic, and everyone needs their insurance and job security. And so, just it was a balancing of a lot of different stressors.
So you start thinking about your own news outlet, and while the Floyd protests are the catalyst, I imagine that as you looked across the media landscape, you know, there must have been other challenges you were trying to solve, gaps you were trying to fill. You started as a reporter at the Daily Press in Newport News. Can you talk about sort of how you saw the industry change for better and worse from the time you were in that job until you left Vox?
Oh, man.
Some of the big challenges that as you guys were starting Capital B, you thought, all right, mm-hmm. these are the holes that we're going to try to fill.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I actually don't know if they still say this in journalism school, but when I was in journalism school 20 years ago, the piece of advice for younger new reporters was like, you start out at a small newspaper and work your way up. And that is like the path that you have to take. And I, particularly then, such a rule follower that I was like, I will do exactly what my professor said I should do, and started a small newspaper and worked my way up to the Washington Post at that time was my goal. So I did that. And it was tough in a lot of ways to be in, you know, I was my early 20s in a newsroom that wasn't incredibly diverse and also was in some ways older. And I didn't feel like it was for me. And because of that, I felt like a failure. Like I had gone to J school to do this thing and I'm like covering Board of Supervisors meetings that I barely even understood, but I really didn't care about.
It's dry.
Super dry. And I was like, well, you know, newspaper, like, no, I'm out of here. And my career ended up veering much more towards digital, but I think now there's tons more options, right? I think there is much more diversity, and this is a good and bad, of news sources for people to work at, particularly straight out of school, that can teach you journalism skills in different ways. But I think that what that early newsroom experience taught me was that local news, which is in decline, is going to continue to have a Black journalist pipeline problem if the only thing that we focus on is like saving the business model, right? Because it's not just about figuring out what to do now that the advertising can't be the primary revenue driver for local news. It's also figuring out how to do better work and reach more people. And if these places can't be places of comfort or places where younger people of color can feel like they can thrive, then those cultural issues will persist. And I don't think they're totally separate from the business issues. And we're going to be leaving wide swaths of audience behind.
When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.
What are some of the blind spots or mistakes that most media outlets make when covering Black America? Obviously, we talked about like one problem is not having enough Black journalists in the newsrooms. But when they do cover Black America, what are some of like the most common mistakes?
I think it's kind of different when you're thinking about local journalism and national journalism. Mm-hmm. But I'll talk about local journalism here. And I think one of the biggest issues is that they only cover bad things that happen in Black neighborhoods. There is a really interesting study out of the Center for Media Engagement at the University of Texas that talked to a bunch of Black news consumers or potential news consumers about how they feel about the media. And most of them have never met a journalist or seen a journalist in their neighborhood in real life. And I think that is just an enormous mistake. Mm-hmm. In terms of building audience, but also in terms of building trust. If the only thing that you kind of care about in your coverage is the worst things that are happening.
Right. So when you guys sat down, just what were those early conversations like? I guess you didn't really sit down together because in the middle of the pandemic,
no,
you were just telling
it was
me.
Calling and Zooming. It all started actually on a text where Okoto and I were and another one of our friends who's a journalist, Janae Desmond Harris, we were all just kind of talking, and Okoto and I just very casually kind of said, what if we started something to address all of these things that we're complaining about and talking about? And then like a few days later, we Zoomed, and then we wrote a concept paper and things were rolling. But like, honestly, our early conversations were so they were so similar to what we ended up actually doing. We came up with a structure and idea that we really like stuck with, which was that we think that really ambitious, original reporting, investigation, accountability, journalism on the national level by and for Black people is kind of missing. And we wanted to fill that hole. But we also very much care about the decline of local news and are concerned that all the the sort of energy on the sidelines to revitalize local news, are white led and are either interested solely in invigorating institutions that have never done right by Black audiences or Black journalists, or helping to prop up organizations that are white led for white audiences. And so we wanted to be a part of that. We thought it was really, really important that we focus on local Black audiences that haven't just lost news in recent years as the news has declined, but have never had it outside of the legacy Black newspapers that are in most major cities. And so we were really serious about finding a local element there and making it a little bit different than what we were trying to do nationally, making it more community focused, making it a source that the community could feel ownership of. So having community engagement editors who are interfacing every day in real life with community members, understanding what they want out of news, what the information they feel like they're missing is, and incorporating it into our editorial strategy.
That's an interesting job. How does that work? Those editors are just going out into the community and meeting with folks? And
yeah, going to community meetings. I mean, a few weeks ago, like they just walked around the mall in Atlanta and talked to people and got a lot of stories out of doing that.
Oh, wow.
You know, we haven't started doing this yet. We just launched on January 31st, but we are, you know, we're going to have like in-person convenings, almost like town hall type meetings, like what a politician would do, but just to find out from the audience, like what they want to know, what they're missing.
What was the thinking behind becoming a nonprofit?
The thinking behind that was that we wanted to do the type of journalism I just described.
Mm-hmm. So not quite a business model that would allow you to do that and be a for-profit.
Yeah, not quite. I mean, I've said this before that I think, particularly in that moment, and when, you know, everyone was having their like kind of brief awakening, I think we could have gotten funding to start it. Mm-hmm. As a for-profit. I just don't think that we would have been able to sustain a business that was solely for-profit. I mean, we want to have a diverse model as a nonprofit and have sponsorships and events along with all of the various ways that we have philanthropic revenue. But leaning solely on advertising or subscriptions or other types of earned revenue, it didn't seem possible. I think we would have major mission creep where we would end up covering entertainment and feeling like we had to publish more stuff and, you know,
a lot more
really,
clickbait.
Or even clickbait, but also just like more. And the more part of it is a real drain and makes it so that you can't be thoughtful. And you can't be as careful as you want to be, and you can't talk to as many people and do as in-depth reporting. And what we really were so audience focused that we really wanted to give people really high quality. And I wasn't positive that we could do that as a for-profit.
Yeah. I really want to zero in on the misinformation part of this. You know, one of the lines in your mission statement: we aim to be an antidote to the misinformation, disinformation, and low-quality, low-context news that clouds our information pipelines. Do you think the challenge with misinformation and disinformation looks any different in Black communities? Like, what made you want to focus on that issue?
I think there are ties that bind across many different demos.
Yeah.
And one of the major ones is, I think, a trust in institution. I think you can find someone like on the very far left and the very far right who both believe that you can't trust anything that government or official sources are telling you. And I think Black people sit kind of like in the middle of that, but the mistrust is rooted in racism,
right?
In systemic racism. And so it, you know, it plays out in government, it plays out in medicine, it plays out in journalism, that, you know, we've been burned. And why wouldn't that keep happening?
Yeah. You know? You mentioned that UT study. What else have you learned about sort of the news and information diet of most Black Americans? Is it, I feel like there's two challenges with this writ large, which is one, people getting information from untrustworthy sources, and then two, sort of a just disengagement altogether with, mm-hmm. with news and political news, which again is, you see across many different demographic groups.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, there's those two. And then I also think that there are people who, what we found is Black people who are not as susceptible to misinformation and disinformation are very interested in the news, but feel like what they have is not for them, is not covering them or their experiences well. I mean, this UT study, you know, a lot of the respondents said they do trust the media and they consume it, but they don't trust the media to tell Black stories. They don't trust the media to understand them, and they don't trust the media to do justice to stories about what's happening in their lives or in their communities. And so that's a weird, again, like, you can't flatten everything. Like, that's a weird sort of contradiction there, where like a lot of Black people might be really loyal to their local news sources, but know that they're highly problematic when it comes to covering them. And this is like kind of just like a metaphor about being Black in America, where, like, you know, we can be really patriotic, but also deeply, deeply, deeply mistrustful of the country because of what the country has done to Black people. And I think, you know, it plays out a lot in various institutions. I think it plays out in media too.
Well, you mentioned this example in Chicago, but the coverage of critical race theory. I mean, it is striking that wherever you fall on the issue, whatever, like, none of the stories are, you don't see people interviewing Black parents, Black teachers, Black students, and how they're dealing with these eruptions in schools and in local school board meetings. It's all like from the white parents, mm-hmm. either from the right-wing activists or from the other parents who don't agree with it. But like the yeah. effect on Black Americans who are in these school districts, the parents and teachers, like it's not a big topic of a lot of these stories.
Right. And the long term effects of it in the yeah. places where these laws are being enacted, and you know, the idea that what is likely going to be happen is Black teachers and Black administrators are going to be just mistrusted just for being,
yeah.
you know? And I think, you know, I'm 40 years old, so this was a long time ago, granted, but, you know, I grew up in Virginia and I know personally what it feels like to be in a classroom being taught history that whitewashes slavery. And like, I remember my burning cheeks and like feeling so almost gaslit, although I wouldn't have known that word back then. That, like, I know from home, I know from my own reading, I know from movies I've watched what was really happening here and the effects of it. And what I'm being taught today is leaving all of that out. And I still feel it. Like, I still remember what that feeling was. And nobody fucking cared. Nobody, you know, like, nobody was like, oh, this is, nobody cared. Nobody cared about that. Nobody cared about that for the Black kids. And to the extent that things are changing in classrooms, I'm not even sure they are that much, but to the extent that they are, it's sort of just such a disheartening thing to see something that would have made me feel less alone in those moments being criminalized.
Yeah.
Over white parents' fear. And then to top it off, it being covered only from white perspectives. And that's it's infuriating.
Well, and I think the other problem there is when it's only covered from white perspectives, the ultimate goal is to sort of persuade people that this is the right thing to do, to teach this full history in our schools. The story you just told about when you were in school is such a powerful, persuasive story. And when you don't have that story in these stories that we're reading, then people aren't persuaded because it's only here in the white perspective, you know? Yeah. And like, that's not the kind of thing you get on Twitter or with quick stories. Like, you actually need sort of longer, complicated interviews, I think, to bring those stories out.
Right.
So like, misinformation, disinformation, lack of trust in institutions that has been caused by, you know, centuries of systemic racism, huge problems. How do you even start to go about fixing those as you guys are sitting down and putting this plan together?
Yeah, like, we can't fix all that. We can't fix that. We can't fix systemic racism. I think that too often this conversation, particularly around misinformation and disinformation, is just too ambitious. You know, like, how are we going to solve this? Well,
people lying.
That's a tough one. Well, yeah, we'll shut down Facebook and Twitter first and then go back to like landlines, no cell phones. It is a huge, sweeping, complicated problem. And so the reason that Akoto and I feel confident that in some small way we can try to make a difference here is because we're taking a much smaller bite of the apple and thinking about how to combat misinformation in local Black communities by creating actual relationships with the people we want to be our audience and giving them the things that they've always wanted and haven't gotten. And it's not just thinking of them as people we need stuff from, but thinking of this as an exchange of information. You tell us something and we're going to tell you something. And I don't think that that's going to be fast, but I think that seeing us in person or seeing the teams in person and seeing when your questions get answered, we think we'll go a long way towards, you know, when there is something that's not true going rampant through the community, or when there are some real questions about vaccines, that we'll be able to be a trusted source. And I don't think that we're going to like convert everyone, but I think that there's some people who are just on the edges and they'll always be on the edges and they want to be on the edges. And like, but I think that there's a very big group that just doesn't have trusted information, and we want to provide it. And the important thing is providing it for free.
And providing it at a local level.
Yes.
So you guys, you have a team in Atlanta, you
yes.
have an operation in Atlanta, and then you have a national team, but it sounds like you guys are going to figure out different cities
yes.
to sort
Ultimately,
of replicate what's going on in Atlanta.
Over the next 5 years, we want to be in around 8 cities.
And that's because part of the philosophy is that local news and being in the communities is one way to actually sort of build this trust.
Yes. Like you have to be there. And we're really prioritizing hiring people who are from those places.
Yeah.
Our whole Atlanta team has a connection to Atlanta. Either they've never left or they, you know, grew up there and left and have come back to home to work for us. And, you know, part of that is having a connection to the community helps you. It adds a layer of caring, really.
Yeah.
Like if like this law is going to affect your grandma the school where you went to sixth grade, that feels different than if you found a really good job in Boston and so moved to Boston to cover transportation for the Boston Globe or something.
Yeah.
Not to shit on the Boston Globe transportation report. I'm just saying it is a different, that is what we're doing is kind of different than what is traditional, where like the best journalist gets the job. And that might mean that they have to spend quite a lot of time learning the community and building trust within the community.
Yeah.
And at a baseline, our staffers can say like, I have a connection to this place.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. you get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Every media company like wrestles with the challenge of building an audience in a fractured environment where there's unlimited amounts of content competing for people's attention. Most of it's shitty clickbait. A lot of it isn't true. Almost all of it is online, especially in people's social media feeds. We think about this at Cricket all the time. Like, how do you think about competing for people's attention with long form, high quality journalism when there's so much crap out there? I realize, obviously, the nonprofit model takes some pressure off, but I imagine just, you know, your goal, even if it's, the goal isn't to make a profit, but it is to get people's attention. How do you think about that challenge?
In very many ways, there is not just one way. You know, I think the in-person community engagement locally is a way to try to make that difference. That we can think about this not just from finding people on social, we're digital, and finding people online, but actually finding people in person and working a kind of word of mouth thing. You just released some research recently that, you know, they polled Black people about their science news habits, and some very high percentage said that they get their science news from like friends and family. And that is a very, like, you know, salient part of like the in-person communication thing. Like, like, if you're not going to read us online, like, how else can we grab you? And I think, you know, we also want to do a lot of partnerships where, you know, there are news organizations that have a lot of audience that we're trying to reach, but maybe won't have the same resources that we do, that we can share our reporting with. There are news organizations that have a lot of resources that we don't have, maybe not the audience, but can work with us on creating something really ambitious that we can serve to our audience. And so we're looking at partnerships from two different ways. And I think that that's the nonprofit model really does kind of open up. It eliminates a lot of competition that exists in for-profit world and opens up a lot of opportunities to just like work with a bunch of people, give people our content to publish.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be from going to capitalbnews.org. Like, we don't care. I mean, we care obviously about traffic, but like not like that.
Yeah.
We care about audience, and it's not always going to be website audience.
Well, how do you think about younger audiences, right? Because they consume less news or on websites have less trust in institutions across races. Like, they have like a TikTok strategy, a Snapchat strategy, like what?
I mean, we're gonna have to. We don't have the resources yet to have TikTok yet, but like, I mean, that's kind of what we're thinking. And the local strategy means that we can kind of go in and like spend some time understanding the demographics and like where people are getting their news, and then tailor our outreach strategy to that. Like in Atlanta, you know, there's tons of Black colleges. There is a large younger Black population. And so we want to be really creative about how we're reaching them. There could be some cities that we go to where population skews older, and we might want to think about creating a print product or something that might reach that demographic more efficiently. Local radio partnerships where we could for free give daily news briefs. We want to think about it in really creative ways, and like no one size fits all. If there's a city where like literacy is really low, maybe our website isn't the place where people are going to get our news. So how are we going to think about that?
That's cool to have all those creative ideas on how to crack that one. I'm sure you saw the New York Times sent out a memo about its social media policy last week where Dean Baquet encouraged the staff to meaningfully reduce how much time they spend on Twitter and warned that feeds become echo chambers. What's your thinking about reporters using social media and particularly Twitter at Capital B?
It's funny. I was thinking about doing a thread about this the other day, but I was like, I don't want to do a thread about Twitter thread about this. But I have a few vantage points on this. Like, I know why newsroom leaders fucking hate their reporters being on social media, because it's where drama is created, and it can be external drama, but it could also end up being internal drama, and it takes away from your ability to run things, to think about the stories that we're writing, if you're constantly trying to like look at people's Twitter feeds. And like, I mean, it's the worst. It's the worst.
Because you, I'm sure when you were at Vox too, like part of your job is to probably monitor everyone's or to like see what's going on when your reporters are getting in Twitter fights, right?
Well, definitely. I mean, yeah, but like
not
also,
like the Vox people are getting in tons of Twitter fights, but
right,
I guess you've
like,
had your.
But like the it's the monitoring part of it that actually don't have time to do, and so what ends up happening is there's sort of like a disproportionate kind of feedback loop that you might get. And so you might not realize that this is where I'm going with this, but like for that reason, I think that like too many rules are bad, because they're impossible to enforce equally. Even if you are enforcing them equally, people are not going to think that you are, and that creates a major drama. And I think that like kind of when you have rules, they are there's so much nuance to like what's a bad tweet, what's a good tweet. I think you end up sort of freezing the people who are really rules oriented so that they don't do what they want to do on Twitter. They're not promoting their stories, they're not feeling like they can show their personality. And then the people who don't follow rules or are line towers will do line towing. And you know, then it's always like, did this person break the rules, did they not? It is dumb. And so I think that the fewer rules the better, because rules mean you have to enforce them. And I think dealing much more one-on-one with people who are not behaving in the spirit of your organization online makes so much more sense, and it's so much less dramatic. And I know that that's much harder to do when you have an organization as big as the New York Times. But just in my opinion, social media policies are, I know that we hear about it from a worker perspective often on Twitter, and those are the people that you see talking about it. But I think that they are an incredible drain on leadership.
Yeah. Well, there's the drama issue and the rules. Did you also have problems with, you know, reporters writing a piece and you're like, this very well reflects what the conversation is on Twitter, but it may not reflect what's actually going on in the country?
Yeah. I mean, I think every newsroom has to have that.
Yeah.
And then there are people who, the reporters who are like trying to correct for that. And then they also end up doing the same exact thing,
right,
because they're on Twitter seeing the conversation and being like, I want to talk about, you know, what's really happening. But then anyone who's not on Twitter is like, why are they even writing this? Like, what is this in response to? I'm so confused. And that person thought that they were like, that they were being the antidote to the Twitter loop. And so yes, I think that
shadowboxing your tweets.
Yes.
This is what Tommy Vitor calls it.
Yeah,
whenever exactly. He's like, we mentioned something on the pod that was like just something on Twitter. Like, why do we mention that on the pod? No one knows what we're talking
right.
about. That was our tweet.
Right. The no one knows what you're talking about thing is I think huge. And I think local helps with that too, because there's just not as much happening there for it to get like dragged into. But I think that the hard thing is like for opinion reporters or for opinion writers, for people who work in newsrooms that maybe don't have the budget to fly you out to places or that have a daily deadline, like it is hard not to get caught up in that because you don't have time to find other stories. And so I think that for employers to really say, like, get off Twitter, and I think the New York Times can because they do have the resources, but like, I think for employers to say, get off Twitter and find your own stories, they have to kind of make space for that.
Yeah, give people the resources to
do it. Give people the resources to do it. Otherwise, you know, you do Twitter stories and they end up doing well because very online people who are involved in those arguments are reading them and sharing them or hate sharing them. And that gets rewarded.
Yeah. So it's now been a little over 2 months since you guys launched, I think. What do you think the biggest challenge is going forward?
Hiring. We still have a lot of hiring to do, and it's a pandemic, and we're a startup. And, you know, I think that it'll be a while before we are, you know, I think there's a startup person who's like, yes, I want to join the startup and build. And there are the, like, I don't want to build. People and finding those people and weeding them out is always hard in a startup. And I think the other thing is just continuing to keep the momentum going on fundraising, on, you know, building and continuing to grow. We raised a lot of money to start, and that's great. But then, like, the weight on my shoulders is like, oh, we have to keep
it doesn't that. Stop. Doesn't stop, does it?
We raise the money. I will have to keep raising the money, and who knows? And you know, I alluded to this earlier, but like, you know, striking while the iron is hot, when people are really interested in racial equity, really thinking about racism in America, and worried about misinformation and disinformation, that's not gonna last forever. And wanting to basically shore up our business so we're ready for the moment when people are like, well, I don't care about Black stuff anymore. I'm not gonna fund this anymore. Gotcha. That's absolutely gonna happen.
Right, because again, our attention span's very short.
Mm-hmm.
Last two questions I'm asking all our guests. I just added a new one on this. What were you doing the last time you realized you needed to put your phone down? When was the last time you were like, I'm too online, I gotta take a break?
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Is this about what you were doing, like, outside of the internet, or like what you were doing, like, with your phone that made you
like,
realize
can,
that
can you
gonna...
remember a time recently, just a time recently when you were like, I gotta unplug, like, I'm too
I actually think that I just mentioned it when I was looking at the social media conversation about social media policies. And I was like, perfect. I have opinions here. I'm going to weigh in. And then I thought about it and I was like, does anybody want this from me right now? Does it need to be said? Does it need to be said by me? And does it need to be said right now? Are three questions that more people should ask themselves.
Those are great questions.
Yeah.
That's a great, I love that piece of advice. And what's your favorite way to unplug?
I have a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. And for the last year and a half, I've been really busy building a news organization from scratch. And I haven't spent the amount of time with them. I mean, they're around, particularly during lockdown, like they were there.
Yeah.
But I wasn't there, you know? And so I want to spend more quality time and do what my son calls like adventures. Because he feels like he's missed out on some things because of the pandemic. I mean, he has, like, all little kids have. So finding little ways to like try a new experience, plant something in the garden or cook something or go on a day trip. I know that it's not like the greatest, it's not self-care, but it's something that makes me happy to see discovery in his face.
Yeah, that's so nice. Lauren Williams, thank you for joining Offline. This was great. It was wonderful to talk to you. This was fun.
Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Andrew Chadwick is our audio editor. Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis sound engineer the show. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Tanya Sominator, Michael Martinez, Andy Gardner-Bernstein, Ari Schwartz, Andy Taft, and Sandy Gerard for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn,
Nar Melkonian, and Amelia Montooth, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.